because of the myths of ministry, I don't get any respect. The myths of ministry arise from stereotypes of ministers and priests and rabbis. By myth, in this sermon, I mean an untrue story that gives a false understanding. A teacher of mine said that because of the myths of ministry, American literature only depicts three types of clergy. There's the perfect, there's the immoral, and there's the ineffectual. Hopefully, I don't fall into any of those categories, or not for very long. But once I was told about a little boy. Little boy, he was acting up in a Methodist church during the sermon, and his mother, who thought he should experience the whole service, said to him, "Shh, shh, be quiet. You have to be quiet during worship." And the little boy, of course, put his finger up and smiled. And she said, "Do you understand why?" And he said, "Shh, yes, people are sleeping." The real problem with the myths of ministry is not how they affect people's view of me or my work. The real problem is they undermine your understanding of the substance of your role and the extent to which each of you can embody the ministry of this congregation, the truths of this community, the demands that it places on the lives of each of us. There are many, many myths. I'm going to briefly touch on six of them today. And the first, the greatest of all the myths, is that ministry is something that is only done by professionals and paid for by the lay folk. It's as if I should place a warning label before every sermon, "Don't try this at home." Except you should. Sometimes you need to find the right words that speak the truth and move people's hearts. Sometimes you should do, perhaps always, do ministry. In my first year in St. Louis, serving honorable, great congregation there, right there in the fall, I went to a minister's conference. And right on the day that I went off to the minister's conference, one key member of our congregation was put into the hospital. And after she was there for a couple days, she complained. She complained bitterly to her friends, "No one from the church is coming to see me." And they were very concerned about that. When I returned from the conference, you know, I was asking what was going on. They told me about how upset she was that no one had come to visit her. And I asked a little bit more, and then I went to visit her. And at one point, I told her about where I had been. And then I said, "I heard that no one had visited you." And she said, "Yeah, no one from the church visited me." And I said, "But I've been talking to people, and I know for a fact that seven people from the congregation visited you, and one of them came every single day." And she said, "Those are just my friends. That's not the church." And I said, "I might represent the church, but your friends, they are the church." Rightly understood, the ministry of a religious community is anything that is done in the service of the core purposes of that community, especially caring for one another. More precisely, ministry is anything consciously done to fulfill the mission of a religious community. For example, if you're helping make coffee or arrange things in the morning because you're supposed to do it or because it's just something we do or it needs to be done, then it's not ministry. But if you're helping with the setup in the morning, if you sweep off a surface or clean something or set something up, and you do it because you know that kind hospitality makes love be the spirit of this fellowship and service be its prayer. If you think your service is helping others in their spiritual growth and sustainable living, then it becomes ministry. And loving babies and making dinners, and inspiring singing, working for the Community Resource Center, all of these are ministry if you do them out of the commitment to that covenant that we renew each week in worship. Now, as a aside, I've been mentioning this before, I want to say that the words you use on a regular basis to invoke your purpose, your mission, are not living words. They are not compelling. They are not vibrant. They are not awake in your minds. I have been here 3 weeks, and I have not heard or seen the words of your covenant or your vision statement shared anywhere except for the word service and the word fellowship. That the word service comes up often. So that one's alive for you. It's vibrant for you. It's active, describing what it is, why it is that you come together and what ministry is supposed to be helping you do. Fellowship is another word that comes up. I did hear peace once. Well, we'll work on words later, but what I'm talking about today is the ministry. There's a lot that I do in ministry, in administration, and counseling, and encouraging, but in the end, my success is determined by what I inspire you to do, or what I help you to do, or what I join with you in doing. My work must impact not only what you do when you're around these people with this name, but how you live your daily lives. And so the second myth of ministry is that ministers are only able to do their special paid work because they're not normal people. This is true, but I'm sorry to say that no one is normal. I remember it was 20 years ago now. I looked up, it seemed like it was not too long ago, but I remember when the great British physicist, scientist, Freeman Dyson, was awarded the Templeton Prize in religion, and he was quite surprised. He said that he thought that the prize could only go to someone who's some exceptional saint or prophet, and he was just a regular guy. But he was honored because he said a leading physicist did not simply talk about ideas of how the universe is created and shaped and how it moves together. He said, science and religion are two windows that people look through, trying to understand the big universe outside, trying to understand why we are here. The two windows give different views, but both look out at the same universe. Neither is complete. Both leave out essential features of the real, and both are worthy of respect. This, I would argue, was good ministry, helping others understand the world, which is the mission of his life, to help others understand why we're here and how to live more fully with one another. He chastised the scientists who had concentrated their incredible power and knowledge and skill into making toys for the rich rather than helping spread knowledge, well-being, and wealth around the world. He said it was possible, even today, that every Egyptian village be as wealthy as Princeton, where he lived. And he still lives there. Yet even very smart people can do very stupid things. I have been a part of Unitarian Universalist churches for a long time, and I have seen this happen many times. We are each limited, we are each foolish in some way or another, but it's also true that we, as Mother Teresa said, we each can do ordinary things with extraordinary love. My elder honored colleague Richard Gilbert, invoked this well in a sermon. It was titled, Just Hang Out and Be Religious. When ministers are charged with the spiritual nurture of the congregations should be charged as well to the mutual ministry. Today, I am eloquent in the pulpit and brilliant. Next week, I'll stumble and bumble through uncertainty and I'll need your forgiveness. Today, I may be a great rock of comfort in a weary land. Tomorrow I'm blown about as the sands of the desert, and I need the oasis of your strength. Today, I may dazzle you with my perspicacity. Tomorrow, I'll forget an appointment. Or I forgot to go to the glow party. I was so disappointed. I did. I forgot. Yeah, it was awesome, and I missed out on it. Blessed be the task of the minister, and blessed the task of the congregation, for ultimately they are one and the same. And the tasks of ministry have no end. And so this brings me to the third myth, that a minister is someone who only works for about an hour or two on Sunday mornings. Yes, leading worship is a vital and important thing. It matters to have someone who is trained and experienced to preach often. But worship is little more than half of my work. Once a colleague of mine noticed a man on Sunday who rarely came. And she walked over to this man, and after a few pleasantries, she said to him, "I don't see you in service often." And the man replied, "Don't let anyone know, but I'm in the secret service." Of course, he was just trying to get out of a lecture. But maybe he understood that the secret service is not the worship service, but all the work that we do outside of worship. This is the center of our common life. But if my only work is preaching, then I'm a very limited minister. And if the only time that you are in fellowship is when you're sitting here in this amphitheater, then you, poor minister, a poor part of this congregation. The work of ministry is huge and demanding, and there is so much need. We were just talking yesterday about immigration, people who have been working on the issues of kindness and compassion and understanding in immigration. After years of struggle, it's only getting worse. The needs are so demanding, calling to us every day to nurture our souls and spirits to be present in the midst of this hurt and broken world is difficult. The great Unitarian-influenced poet of the 20th century, Rabindranath Tagore, wrote, "I slept," speaking of spirituality, he said, "I slept and I dreamt that life was joy. I awoke and I saw that life was service. I acted and behold, service was joy." When you hear that someone in this fellowship is in trouble, do you call them up and offer help, or call someone else who knows them and offer help? If you meet someone from this congregation unexpectedly, maybe in a grocery store, do you spend a little extra time to connect? Maybe you go to community meetings, and there you're working to help all people, not just the people you see in this place on Sunday, but helping all people dwell together in peace. If so, then you are doing the work of the fellowship. You are making community. You are sharing meaningful work. You are doing ministry. Even the way that we run something like a committee meeting can be ministry, not just by doing a check-in or a chalice lighting at the beginning, but by running the meeting in such a way that we say our time is valuable, in a way that we say that the contribution of each person is honored and worthy and important. Or on a work day on the grounds, how do we treat one another? Wherever and whenever we meet, we can affirm our UU identity. When we light a candle in a moment of silence, we can recall the moments together that we have of high resolve and our shared sources of inspiration. The unbound power of ministry is enunciated in an anonymous piece called There Is Ministry. Ministry occurs in places and circumstances likely and unlikely. In churches, sometimes. In prisons and hospices and hospitals. By cribs and cradles. In factories and offices and stores and courtrooms and cocktail lounges and clinics and garages and hovels and mansions and at bus stops and in diners. Wherever there is a meeting that summons out our better selves, wherever our lost is found, our fragments are reunited, our wounds begin healing, our spines are strengthened, and our muscles grow strong for the task there. There is ministry. Ministry has ends and goals, like summoning our best selves, and can be done anywhere. So the fourth myth is that ministers are the people who simply tell others what to believe. I know of many ministers who are glad to tell you what to believe. But I know that most people in their religious practice will ignore their leaders and choose for themselves, even outside of this congregation. A few years ago, a member of my congregation was talking to one of her Catholic relatives, and they were talking about birth control, two young adults talking about birth control, how they used it, what it was in their life. And then at one point, the Unitarian Universalist said, "You know that the Pope is against all this." And the Catholic said, "No, he's not." She had just decided what was wise and what was true and assumed that her leader would have the same attitude. Yesterday, National Public, and this early this morning, the National Public Radio show, the TED Radio Hour, was about doubt and belief. It sounded like many of my sermons. It was amazing. One key insight was that doubt is essential ingredient, a real, true, and vibrant and living faith. Faith is something that comes from the word of trust, not the word knowledge. It's about trust. What do you trust? What can you trust? What do you have to trust? What are you forced to put your trust in? One woman on the show emphasized that confidence was better than certainty. Let go of certainty and simply seek what gives you confidence. We say that often. We know from experience that a belief that has been chosen is always more powerful than one that has been given to you. And we know that every belief is prone to error and incompleteness. And so we have chosen to be free of doctrine. Lately, we've been raising up the realization that racism is not merely a belief or an idea about superiority of people. It's not merely the idea of race. It's also just a pattern of living, a way of living that allows the patterns and systems of oppression and segregation and degradation to thrive unconsciously, visible only to the oppressed at those moments when the thumb comes down and the foot comes down. Someone didn't even notice. So we must judge the consequences of our actions as ministers of truth. We must name injustice. We must denounce powers and structures of evil in this world. But our job is not to judge people and not to tell people what to believe and not to tell people what are the right words and the wrong words. Our job is to love people, to seek to understand human beings and to encourage them to live better lives. The job of a Unitarian Universalist minister, your job and my job, is to understand and then use that understanding in the service of living and loving well and sustainably on this good earth. So part of ministry is to lead. And that undermines the sixth last myth of ministry that I'm holding up today, is the idea that ministers are people who are rulers and bosses. Of course, I'm responsible for very much. I play a key executive role in your community, but I am rarely in control of anything, least of all this congregation. Leadership is really something that's determined by a style of participation, not by an official role. And the fact is that each of us can be leaders. Each can take charge of some part of the organization and influence its life. Each of us can take a moment in which we remind people of why we're doing what we're doing. What is the value that it serves? To be a leader is to influence others. It has many sources. Seek the sources of leadership. Look for those brief moments, sometimes once in a lifetime, where you can influence others on the quality of someone's living and the purpose and the meaning and the awareness, the meaning of their living. To illustrate this, I want to tell a story that I heard happened recently to Pope Francis. I tell stories about Pope Francis because he's kind of an image of the ultimate myth of ministry. He was approaching his limousine at an airport in Chicago, and he was moved to drive the car just like a regular person. And he told the chauffeur this, and the chauffeur got in the back, and the Pope started driving. He's driving on the highways, opening it up, you know, like a new driver, someone who hasn't driven in a while. He's adding on the speed, feeling the car, getting exciting, and then the flashing lights are coming up behind him, red and blue lights coming up behind him. Pulled the car over to the side, and the police officer came up, right? Police officer comes up, looks in the car, looks around, and said, "Hold on, I need to call this in. Stay here." The police officer goes back to the car, and he calls into the main office. He goes, "I need to talk to the chief," and they patch him into the chief. He says, "Chief, I've got a terrible situation. I've got a really important person, but I don't know how to handle it." And he goes, "Oh, is it the mayor again?" And he goes, "It's not the mayor." And he goes, "What, the governor?" And he goes, "No, it's not the governor." "What, President Trump?" And he goes, no, it's someone far more important than that." And the chief says, "Who is it? Who did you pull over?" And he goes, "That's the problem. I don't know who he is, but he's got the Pope as his chauffeur." Thank you. The point is that I'm just the chauffeur here. And you, each of you, is the most really important person. You are the ministers. Beyond study and writing and choosing and coordinating that goes into every service, I have much more work to do, and so do you. Caring for one another, and forging good, sustainable, enduring lives of bringing justice and love into human living. And it's not all work. It's not all formal service. It's why we have this wonderful space. Crescent moon. Most of you cannot see the crescent moon, but I think it is so cool that the moon at the end of its circle is hovering over us in worship. Those moments of wonder when we take a moment to see with wonder and to share that with one another, that is ministry. Laughter. Getting others to laugh in the midst of this difficult life, that is ministry, if you think of it as ministry. And I have seen ministry in the way that some of you talk to your children and play with them. And I have seen it when you are gardening and you share your gardening, results of your gardening, or you share your art or your talent or your creativity with other people. These events that we sell at the auction in which we share with one another the creativity of hospitality and togetherness. It's ministry when you stand silently with one another and look out over the vast, wondrous ocean or into the mysterious darkness and the beckoning stars. And I'm just a part of all that. I'm a minister to ministers, all who are living not by the myths, by the transforming truth and abiding goodness of ministry.